So thank you, everyone, for tuning in today. This is a media briefing on a new white paper that Nuclear Information and Resource Service is publishing today. My name is Tim Judson, and I'm the Executive Director at NIRS and the principal author of the white paper. And we are pleased to be joined also by two other experts with firsthand experience in state-level nuclear power plant closures and economic interventions. Damon Moglen, Senior Advisor at Friends of the Earth, who was a leader in negotiations on the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant Phase-Out Agreement 2 years ago. And Dave Kraft, Director of Nuclear Energy Information Service based in Chicago, who was involved in negotiations leading up to the enactment of the Future Energy Jobs Act in 2016. So NIRS published this white paper really to address a serious policy need that's at the state and federal levels around the closures of nuclear power plants. What we have found in observing and participating in these processes at the state and federal level over the last several years is that states are really in need of a proactive, practical, and cost-effective way to manage the closures of nuclear power plants. What we see happening is that we have an energy system in the U.S. and in other countries that is in a sort of generational transition. We have aging infrastructure, that's in many places been in place for decades. There are emerging technologies that are disrupting the traditional energy generation and distribution business, including renewables, but also other new technologies such as energy storage, demand response, and those sort of things. And there are also new public policy priorities that are affecting the way that energy planning and energy outcomes are being directed. For instance, with preferences for renewable energy, air quality standards, greenhouse gas emission reductions, and other grid modernization priorities to update energy infrastructure and to integrate these new technologies. What we've also seen markedly over the last decade is a dramatic change in energy and electricity prices in the U.S. There's been a sustained reduction in energy prices from where they were a decade ago. That was initially sort of driven by reductions in the price of natural gas, but also has been influenced by stagnant and declining energy demand, an excess of generation capacity. For instance, in certain regions like the Mid-Atlantic and Midwest, it's produced there's over 20%. Reserve margin for generation capacity, the advancement of peak load management and demand response programs to reduce peak energy prices, and this is what's increasingly driving trends going forward, is the rapid growth of low-cost renewable energy sources, principally onshore wind and solar, but increasingly will involve offshore wind and other resources as well. This has placed higher cost power plants to become uncompetitive. This has principally affected coal generation in the last decade with many power coal plant retirements, but there's also been a trend of increasing closures of nuclear reactors. There have been 7 reactors that have shut down since 2013. More than a dozen a dozen reactor closures have been announced or scheduled in the last couple of years through 2025. We've also seen other reactors at risk of closure, including 6 reactors in New York and Illinois, whose closures have been averted at least temporarily by state economic interventions in the form of subsidies. What we have seen is that the trend with nuclear power plants has been really blamed on natural gas prices to a large extent, but in fact the one of the driving factors that's really been ignored in this process is the economics of nuclear reactors themselves. We have an aging fleet of nuclear power plants across the country. The U.S. has the oldest nuclear power plant fleet in the world. The average age of reactors in the U.S. is now over 38 years, and about half of the reactor fleet is actually over 40 years old, which was the original life expectancy of these plants when they were built. And so going forward, what we really see is that nuclear power plants are likely to becoming more uneconomical as they age, due to the extremely expensive costs of maintaining and operating these aging reactors as they get older. This is really a unique feature of nuclear power plants, that they are so capital intensive to build, but also to maintain towards the end of their lives. And one of the things that has happened over the last 10 or 15 years is that the operating costs of reactors have steadily increased. The Nuclear Energy Institute published a report in 2014 that documented a more than 50% increase in the average operating costs of nuclear reactors between 2002 and 2012. And so as reactors age and require refurbishment, those operating costs are likely to continue to remain high, even as energy prices, have been remaining low, which is, driving some analysts, including Bloomberg, to anticipate that by 2020, up to half of the nuclear reactors in the country are going to be uneconomical to operate. It's really difficult to tell how quickly and how rapidly reactors might close in the future, but it's really important for states to have processes in place to be able to manage the impacts of power plant closures. What we've seen is that there's been a real gap in states' ability to plan for these events when they occur. This particularly in states where they deregulated their electricity markets back in the 90s. Originally, that was done, in part to avoid states having to become responsible for maintaining the operating costs of nuclear power plants and other expensive generators. But as these reactors have gotten older, states are finding themselves in a situation where utilities are threatening to close reactors in a precipitous fashion, and states are confronted with a gap in how they manage the impacts of those closures. In some cases, it really seems like utilities have sort of exploited that policy gap in order to leverage uneconomical subsidies for these reactors going forward. So what we've seen is that, there's been a number of proposals at the state and federal levels in the last several years, beginning in 2014, with the draft, Obama administration's draft Clean Power Plan, as well as proposals in Ohio and Illinois and other states, by utility companies like Exelon and First Energy, to wrest economic support for these aging reactors that are becoming uncompetitive. Most of these proposals have failed so far, including in Ohio and at the federal level. But four states have enacted subsidies in Illinois, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. The rationales that have been provided for these subsidies have varied, but primarily fall into the category of either maintaining electricity system reliability or ensuring mitigation of or reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. The reliability argument has proven to be unsuccessful in justifying these types of sustained economic subsidies. And there's good reason for that. We have procedures in place to ensure the reliability of the transmission and distribution systems, when power plants retire, and those processes actually create a really strong framework for how to deal with reactor closures, when there's concerns about greenhouse gas emissions and those sort of things. What we found is that the programs that have been instituted at the state level in the last couple of years in these four states have really been sort of shotgun marriages that really don't meet good public interest standards for how we should be managing our energy system. These subsidies have proved to be uneconomical and expensive, and imposing billions of dollars in costs on consumers over the next decade or so. They're very long-term subsidy programs, which don't provide for real phase-out planning or contingency plans for when reactors do shut down. And the justifications for the subsidies have also been questionable in many cases. For instance, initially in New York and Illinois, the rationale for subsidizing reactors was that they were, financially losing millions of dollars of money every year, and they could not recover their costs for operation through revenues available in the competitive electricity markets. In more recent states that have adopted these subsidies, namely New Jersey and Connecticut, it's actually been acknowledged that the reactors in question are in fact quite profitable and are actually obligated to continue operating for at least 3 to 5 years under contractual agreements with the regional grid operators, to maintain reliability. The arguments that have been proffered by the operators in those cases have been that while the reactors are profitable, they're not profitable enough to justify continue operating on a going forward basis. The problem is that the states are confronted with a complex set of implications for when reactors close. And that includes, not just, system reliability and potentially greenhouse gas emissions concerns, but also the local economic impacts on the communities where power plants are located, and the workers who are employed at those plants. The situation with nuclear reactors is unique relative to coal and other generating facilities, in that they employ large workforces in the hundreds of workers up to 1,000 or more, and the prospect of short-term job losses in rural communities where these economic impacts can be really significant has been daunting for policymakers to get control of. And that has left states vulnerable to these very high pressure campaigns by large politically powerful utility companies demanding immediate economic relief in order to continue operating these reactors. What we found in these cases, for instance, in New York, was that the subsidies for nuclear reactors were put in place without really considering alternatives. And that's evident in when you look at how cost effective these subsidies are for nuclear compared to other energy programs in the state. For instance, in New York, when New York enacted its clean energy standard in 2016, it was part of a package, with a tier for subsidizing 4 aging nuclear reactors in the state. Alongside, 2 other tiers, that were designed to achieve a 50% renewable energy target by 2030, and the estimated costs for increasing renewable energy to meet the 50% target were 3 times less than the costs of the subsidies that are being allocated to the nuclear plants. In fact, in the first 2 years of this program, New York consumers are being charged about 200 times as much in subsidies for nuclear reactors as they are for advancing renewable energy under this new renewable energy standard. When you look at the rationale for the program, which was to ensure that the state meets a 40% emissions reduction goal by 2030. There was really, insufficient justification for the nuclear subsidies. For instance, the nuclear subsidies only run until 2029, which means that the economic supports for these reactors are going to end a year before the state's emissions target. And part of the reason for the program ending in 2029 is that 2 of the 4 reactors that are being subsidized are among the oldest reactors in the country, and their 60-year extended licenses expire in 2029. The program did not contain any contingency planning or any procedures for how to ensure that the state was going to meet its emissions target in 2030. With the potential closure of a number of these reactors in 2029, this was really a sort of a policy gap that the state was made aware of but didn't fulfill in terms of how to line up these energy programs with the state's environmental goals. And part of the problem with that as well is that the economic impacts on local communities that were really driving some of the political impetus for the program, there was nothing in place to mitigate those impacts. And so the subsidies to the nuclear reactors were really sort of, you know, putting the state in a holding pattern, against the economic impacts of these reactors shutting down. Now, what we identified in the course of that proceeding was an alternative that would actually make a lot of sense and build on the process by which reactor retirements and other power plant retirements are managed to ensure grid reliability. And so in this report, we've kind of laid that out in a way that states could see as a practical alternative to providing these long-term uneconomic subsidies to aging nuclear reactors that are going to be closing within a few years anyway. And what that involves is a process that starts, that builds on this, on the deactivation process that the regional grid operators use to ensure reliability. That process starts with a deactivation notice that has to be filed by the operator or the owner of the power plant, and then that triggers the conduct of a reliability study conducted by the grid operator. To assess any impacts that might result from the closure of that reactor that would affect the reliable electricity service that's mandated under the Federal Power Act. If such an impact is identified, that triggers a process for seeking solutions to that problem. Usually, a competitive process whereby an RFP is put out or a request for proposals for other energy generators or efficiency providers or transmission developers to provide a solution to mitigate the reliability impact that's identified. If no cost-effective alternative is discovered through that process, within the time period that the owner of the power plant is planning to retire, then the grid operator initiates what's called a reliability must-run contract to provide sufficient cash flow to the owner of the power plant to continue operating until other more cost-effective solutions to the reliability issue can be implemented. We actually saw this work very effectively in 2014 and 15 with one of the nuclear reactors in New York. The R.E. Ginna reactor was potentially going to be retired in 2014 or 2015 by its owner or its operator Exelon, and so the grid operator, the New York Independent System Operator, conducted a reliability study, found that there was a local transmission vulnerability that prevented enough power from being imported into the region if Ginna were to close. And the New York Public Service Commission, the State Utility Commission, initiated a proceeding to ensure that the Ginna would continue operating until alternatives could be implemented. What was found was that the state originally anticipated it would take 3.5 to 5 years to implement the transmission system upgrades necessary to enable Ginna to retire. Once the utility started looking at it from a practical standpoint of having to subsidize this reactor from their consumers, the utility found a much faster way to address the reliability issue that enabled the reactor to close in just 2 years instead of 3.5 years, and saved consumers $120 million in subsidies that would have otherwise been charged to keep Ginna operating for the additional amount of time. It really showed that the procedures that are in place to manage the reliability impacts of reactor closures could be adapted, to the environmental context. And so what we have laid out is a sort of a parallel two-track process by which emissions impacts of reactor closures can be evaluated against, states' emissions targets, and within their within their energy planning processes. So that, you know, so what we're proposing is essentially a process whereby, you know, when a reactor deactivate, when a reactor owner is planning to retire, that they would submit a deactivation notice, and that it would trigger both a greenhouse gas emissions impact study as well as a reliability impact study. And that would, so if there were going to be impacts on the state's ability to meet its greenhouse gas emissions goals, for instance, New York's 40% by 2030 goal, that would trigger, a competitive process to identify solutions to mitigating that impact more cost effectively. And, you know, in the case that such impacts can't be mitigated, in the timeframes that are necessary by the state, then the potential for a transitional subsidy for the nuclear power plant could be available, but that would have to be competitive with other options for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and it would also have to involve a time frame within which the reactor could be phased out. Now, this necessitates the states having some proactive policies in place in order to make this process work, including having emissions reductions targets that against which reactor closures can be evaluated, but also community and worker protection plans that can mitigate the local economic impacts. We see this as really an issue of political inertia that is creeping up in the energy system around the implications of this generational shift in how we're producing and distributing electricity in the country. And so, with worker and community protection plans in place, the state can ensure that these various impacts are adequately managed in order to make sure that we're able to both achieve the greenhouse gas emissions reductions that are becoming increasingly important, especially in relation to the reports that have recently been issued by the federal government and by the UNFCCC's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now there are some other examples of how these processes can be managed, which Damon Moguln from FOE is going to talk about next, as well as some additional lessons learned from the example of what's happened in Illinois. So with that, I'll hand it over to Damon Moguln, and then Dave Kraft.
Thank you, Kim. Good morning. This is Damon Moguln. I'm the Senior Strategic Advisor at Friends of the Earth U.S. Friends of the Earth is the world's largest grassroots environmental network, and we have 75 member organizations and countries around the world. Here in the U.S., we've been around for 47 years and have an activist and members list of over 1.5 million supporters spread across every state in the country. As you all know, in the last weeks, two important reports have been issued in regard to the escalating crisis that we face with climate change. The IPCC, or Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, issued an expert report in October in which the world's leading climate scientists warned that climate change is occurring even faster than has been projected, and that limiting global warming will now require far-reaching and unprecedented changes to human behavior and how we use and produce energy. And this past Friday, the U.S. government released its fourth national climate assessment by the U.S. Global Change Research Program, which involves a team of 13 federal agencies. The report concludes that average global temperature is much higher and rising more rapidly than, quote, anything modern civilization has experienced, end quote, and warns that in the U.S. alone, this century, we face thousands of climate-related deaths, food scarcity, and the loss of hundreds of billions of dollars to the U.S. economy. And that is not the worst-case scenario. So this is the dire situation that we must face when we talk about how we use and produce energy. This is literally now a question of life and death, of whether or not our children and their children will live in a world beset by catastrophic climate change. The bad news is that we are failing to tackle these issues at the scale and with the rapidity necessary. The good news is that we actually have the means to address the problem, namely safe, clean, and less expensive greenhouse gas-free efficiency, renewable energy, and energy storage technologies. What we need to do is undertake a massive Apollo-style project to ramp up these greenhouse gas-free energy resources while moving decisively to shut down the failed, dirty, and dangerous fossil fuel and nuclear energy technologies that have characterized the 20th century. Given what needs to be done, the suggestion by some that we rely on nuclear power is nothing less than a dangerous and misguided distraction. As this excellent report points out, there have been no newly built and completed nuclear reactors in the U.S. in 30 years. After some 60 years and hundreds of billions of dollars in direct and indirect subsidies, nuclear power is barely generating one-third as much electricity as do fossil fuels. There is no renaissance when it comes to nuclear power. Instead, what we have, and as Tim has suggested, in the United States, is utilities and merchant operators operating the oldest nuclear reactor fleet in the world, with the priority being on protecting profits. The reality here is that we face a disaster waiting to happen. We are running reactors designed in the 1960s and constructed with 1970s materials beyond the 40-year lifetime for which they were designed. This is foolhardy. Under the stress of decades of intense, constant radiation and thermal bombardment, concrete and steel begin to fall apart. There will be failures, potentially disastrous ones, if we continue to run these old machines. No one would accept the construction of these outdated reactors for operation now, and yet we are supposed to pretend that it is okay to run them for decades, design their design lifetimes. This makes no sense when we have cheaper, safer, and cleaner greenhouse gas-free energy deployable now, namely energy efficiency, renewable energy, and energy storage resources. The billions of dollars that could be spent on failing nuclear power plants should instead be spent directly on renewable energy. And instead of making state and regional energy plans, assuming that decrepit and dangerous nuclear plants will continue to operate, we should instead be making plans to replace fossil and nuclear power generation with renewable energy and energy efficiency. Now, I want to spend the remainder of my time with you to talk about the historic agreement to close and replace the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors in California as proof that old nuclear reactors can and will be replaced more cheaply, more safely, and more cleanly by renewable energy and efficiency. The Diablo Canyon Agreement grew out of closure talks started by Friends of the Earth and the Pacific Gas and Electric Company, one of the biggest utilities in the country. Based on an economic and technical analysis commissioned by Friends of the Earth, we argued with PG&E that it would be cheaper for California ratepayers if the aging reactors at Diablo Canyon would be phased out and replaced by a suite of greenhouse gas-free efficiency, renewable energy, and energy storage resources. After careful consideration, PG&E agreed. 6 months of negotiations between the utility, unions, local communities, and environmentalists led to the historic announcement of a proposed closure replacement agreement in June of 2016. In announcing the agreement, PG&E stated, and I quote, "The orderly replacement of Diablo Canyon with greenhouse gas-free resources will be the reliable, flexible, and cost-effective solution for Pacific gas and electric customers." The agreement calls for PG&E to close the Diablo reactors in 2024-2025 at the end of their current licenses. In turn, using the time remaining, three tranches of greenhouse gas-free resources are to be procured to replace the needed power otherwise coming from the reactors. An employee retention, retraining, and development program is also called for at a cost of $350 million. And the community impacts mitigation program, initially suggested for $50 million, but now increased to $85 million, is an integral part of the agreement. Since then, the proposed agreement has worked its way through the California Public Utilities Commission and in turn through the California legislature, which passed legislation in the summer of 2018, affirming the agreement in full. The legislation in turn was signed into law by Governor Brown in September of this year. This agreement has established a green blueprint for the closure of nuclear and fossil fuel plants around the country. It establishes that energy efficiency and renewables can and will replace fossil fuels and nuclear power generation, and will do so greenhouse gas-free, cheaper, safer, and cleaner. This agreement stands as concrete proof that if our priority is to produce greenhouse gas-free energy so as to address climate change, the cheaper, safer, and cleaner way is with renewable energy and energy efficiency. Finally, it is important to note that the Diablo Closure Agreement in part was based on the recognition that 21st century energy systems will not prioritize so-called baseload power, but will instead require flexible decentralized systems. Indeed, it was revealed that a large baseload plant like Diablo Canyon is already making it harder to increase the amount of renewable energy, solar, and wind power in the system. Simply put, the nuclear power will increasingly impede the inclusion of the increased sun and wind power that California is committed to producing. This is an extremely important lesson for the rest of the country. If we want to increase the amount of greenhouse gas-free renewable energy, nuclear power is in fact a hindrance. Not just a hindrance because operating decrepit and dangerous nuclear plants will require billions of unnecessary dollars, but because the power from those plants will crowd out the power that will otherwise come from cheaper, safer, and cleaner renewable energy. Let me end there, and I'd be happy to take questions later. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Damon. And before Dave starts, I just want to let everyone know if you want to get in the queue to ask a question after Dave's presentation, just press *6 on your phone, and you'll be put in the queue. Dave?
Thank you, Tim, and I want to thank the members of the press and others for being on the call today. I'm Dave Kraft, Director of Nuclear Energy Information Service. We're based in Chicago. We were formed in 1981 to serve as a watchdog in Illinois of the nuclear power industry on reactors and waste. We gave our first climate presentation in 1988 when there was a huge drought in Illinois, and we were finding that nuclear plants were being taken offline because they were thermally polluting rivers when they were needed the most. We then created a program called You Can't Nuke Global Warming in 1999, which we continue to this day, which illustrates why nuclear power is ill-suited to do anything to mitigate the climate disruption that we're experiencing. I'd also mention on a personal note that I was in Group 4 of Al Gore's climate project training after the movie The Inconvenient Truth came out. So we're no strangers to the climate issue, and we're definitely no strangers to the nuclear issue. I want to touch on 4 points, and we may not get into all the details. You can contact me afterwards by email if you want them. But these 4 points, I think, illustrate what's been missing in the debate so far. Using the Illinois Future Energy Jobs Act legislation sort of as a template for what you can expect of the nuclear industry moving forward on climate change. Now, this Future Energy Jobs Act was enacted in December 2016. I'm just going to go over some of the details of it so you're up to steam. And it was a process that had actually taken almost 3.5 years to bring to fruition. The environmental community actually was out of the blocks first in Illinois with a bill called the Clean Jobs Act in 2015, which was set up to address the Obama administration's carbon goals. We want to make sure Illinois had a good plan in place that emphasized renewables and energy efficiency. And so that legislation was passed or was promoted in 2015. However, Exelon and ComEd balked, and they wouldn't go along with it, so they created this Future Energy Jobs Act, which was elected. So I'm going to tell you what we got and what we didn't get, and then I'll move to the second point, which is what's missing in all of these discussions. The bill gave considerable concessions to the renewable energy and energy efficiency sectors, at least compared to what was going on in Illinois before then. It calls for 1,300 megawatts of new wind by 2030 and 2,700 megawatts of solar by 2030 as well. But that came at a price. And that's why we don't refer to this so much as Fija, as a nuclear hostage crisis, which was created rather disingenuously by Exelon way back in December of 2013 when they first recognized that some of their reactors were no longer economically competitive. They were looking for a handle to look for bailouts and subsidies, and they latched on the environmental and climate issue because reactors, of course, don't produce CO2 in the process of generating. So the nuclear hostage crisis came at a price. $2.3 billion bailout of Exelon's uncompetitive reactors at Clinton and Quad Cities over the next 10 years. It's interesting to note that Exelon originally had asked for 5 years, but the outgoing governor, Governor Rauner, in his private negotiations, along with House Speaker Madigan, extended that to 10 years for some reason. So Exelon's shareholders get $2.3 billion. And of the 1,500 jobs that were protected at Clinton and Quad Cities, that comes out to about $1.57 million per job saved. We also get, as a result of the extension of 10 years, an additional 1,000 tons of high-level radioactive waste, which will be manufactured at those plants, which otherwise might have closed and not been produced. Now, what didn't we get? Throughout the whole process, my organization and others were calling for what Tim touched on earlier, which was a proactive just transitions program, which is put in place prior to reactor closures, which protect the tax base, the job base, the economic futures of the reactor communities. We pushed very hard for that, and we were rebuffed, again, largely through Exelon and ComEd's lobbyists in Illinois. We felt we could probably get more renewable energy than what I quoted you earlier. And if you take a look at what the American Wind Energy Association's potential is for Illinois alone, the current 80-millimeter hub wind turbines that we have in operation now have a potential in Illinois for 191 gigawatts of power in the future. That translates roughly to 174 Clinton nuclear power plants. So the notion, first of all, that we don't have the ability through renewables to meet a climate change world is wrong. And secondly, not only that, there's far more wind potential here than using natural gas as your option. And you don't have to worry about water supplies being impacted negatively. We also did not get plant closure dates in the Fija nuclear hostage crisis bill. So these were flaws that hopefully will be corrected in the future. But the thing we need to underscore in the Illinois process is that environmental groups were being portrayed as changing their mind about nuclear power. We had to fight a Wall Street Journal article which came out in 2016 which made that contention. It was a very bitter exchange over 2 weeks. But it's come up again recently that in the context of the UCS report and the climate issues before us, that environmentalists are changing their mind. It's important to note, though, that political duress should not be interpreted as support for nuclear power. We got the renewable energy stuff only at a price of $2.3 billion in bailout, and it should be very much underscored that the delay that the Exelon Corporation, and I'm sure around the country other nuclear utilities, have thrown in the path of renewable energy has prevented millions of tons of CO2 emissions that would have been avoided, which didn't happen because renewable energy was not constructed because of the political climate. And that brings me to the second point. The political process is the big elephant in the living room that's absent from many of these reports, including the IPCC at the international level, but also down to the local level here in Illinois. We viewed Exelon as an opportunistic bad actor manipulating the climate issue to get bailouts. It's a new business model for them. A recent Crain's Chicago Business article pointed out that in 2017, of the 41 cent per share increase that was experienced by Exelon shareholders, 39 cents of it came from the ZEC, the zero emission credit, plus the capacity market payments. So this is a new business model for the nuclear industry. You cry wolf, you get bailouts, and the proportion of your dividends that are increased comes from these zero emission credits. Now, I can confidently say that the nuclear hostage crisis FIDIA bill was not about environmental quality. And again, I refer to a Crane's Chicago Business article of November 11th, 2016, where I quote, "This underscores the company's emphasis on preserving and creating jobs rather than the environmental benefits of keeping nuclear plants open. The bill," and here's the Exelon quote, "was not driven by the Clean Power Plan, although it had meeting with those goals as an added benefit," unquote. Exelon said in a statement, further quote, "This bill is about economics, both for Illinois consumers and for the state's future prospects for economic development," unquote. So let's take the fig leaf off of the nuclear industry's pronouncements about nuclear power in a global warming world. So the political context is extremely important to analyze in the context of whether we move forward with renewables or whether the nuclear industry will obstruct that. And we can take a look even currently at the power that Exelon, which is the nation's largest nuclear utility and the largest electric utility, has exerted on the transition process to a new governor here in Illinois. J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat, was recently elected to replace Rauner, and his transition team has as its co-chair Exelon's utility division chair, Ann Pramaggiore, who used to be at Commonwealth Edison here in Chicago, and ComEd's Joe Dominguez, who happened to be the nuclear person responsible for a lot of the negotiations on the FIDIA bill. So the political influence of the nuclear industry to manipulate the perception of what's going on is enormous and has to be taken into account. And it kind of belies the predictions or the recommendations in reports like the Union of Concerned Scientists just put out if it's ignored. Now, in the interest of time, I'm going to curtail some of my remarks, but I have to point out one thing. Since we started our 1999 program of You Can't Nuke Global Warming, we've operated by what we call the 2x4 rule. And what that means is that in any energy resource, whether it's wind, solar, nuclear, coal, any resource that has to be examined in the context of climate change abatement has to meet a 2x4 standard. The 2 stands for the constraints, which are time and money, and the 4 are the 4 rules that must be observed if you're going to pick this energy resource, and that is, a resource has to take the most carbon out of the atmosphere, number 1, number 2, in the shortest amount of time, number 3, at the lowest cost possible, and here's the most important one, number 4, without creating additional or worse environmental or social factors that could be equally detrimental to the planet. And we have pointed out repeatedly to the Illinois legislature during the FIDIA debates and other times that nuclear power fails the 2x4 rule on all 6 counts. And I particularly call attention to the one, number 4 of the rules, because one of the, in fact, the most precious resource in a climate-disrupted world is going to be water. In Illinois, 80% of our surface water is utilized in the production of electricity. And nuclear plants use more water than most coal plants as well. So moving forward, water will be the critical resource, yet it's being recommended that we hitch our wagons to a resource that will be most vulnerable, as I pointed out earlier, in severe drought circumstances like we experienced in 1988. So nuclear is ill-suited from an environmental standpoint in meeting the climate crisis. So the final piece I'll just mention is that, fortunately, some legislators, both at the federal and state level, have been listening. And there is federal legislation that has been introduced in this past session, which has promoted the notion of just transitions, most notably Senator Tammy Duckworth and Representative Brad Schneider of Illinois have put forward a bill called the Stranded Act to deal with communities facing reactor closures. Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii had put out a bill which is also dealing with the just transitions for fossil fuel communities. And most recently, Marcy Kaptur in Ohio has put out H.R. 6814, the Troubled Nuclear Power Plants Communities Assistance Act, which is beginning to address the issue that Tim raised at the beginning, that communities will be negatively affected, the best time to plan for dealing with those problems is before they become problems, not when your nose is up against the fan blade and companies like Exelon opportunistically manipulate the climate situation to get bailouts. So I'll stop there, and we'll see if we have questions on any of that. And I'll be happy to provide more details on any of the things I said, including the bill numbers, by email, which is neis@neis.org. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dave. And so now we'll open up for questions. If you have a question, please just dial *6 on your phone, and you'll get in the queue, and you'll be unmuted, you know, in order. Okay, we have a first question from SP Global.
Yes, hi, this is Jim Ostroff. And a very pertinent question, you have issued this white paper. How do we get a copy of it? I don't see it on the website.
It should be posted on the front page of the website now, and it is on the, if you scroll down to breaking news, it's the first item on the left.
Okay, well, now it's there. All right. I'll figure it out. I'll see. But can I just say, I see here it's this is a press release. Is the full report here?
Yes. If you click that link, there's a link at the to download the paper.
That's fine. I'll do that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any other questions? If you have a question, just dial *6. Oh, and sorry, yes, the NIRS website is www.nirs.org. And as I just described to Jim, if you scroll down to where it says breaking news, there's a link to the press release, which has a link to the report on the left side. Okay. Well, not seeing any other hands raised to ask questions, we will go ahead and end the press briefing, and we will have a recording of it posted on the NIRS website this afternoon, hopefully by 1 o'clock. Oh, sorry, another question just popped up. I'll unmute you now.
Could you, this is Linda Lewis in Chicago. Could you give some more detail about the 1,000 tons of radioactive waste in Illinois and in the larger picture in the country? Is it 1,000 tons a year? Is it 1,000 tons for the 10 years? And what is the cost of that, of taking care of it at this?
Yeah,
some of
the Dave,
cost.
This is Dave Kraft. I use that number, so I'll answer that. Typical reactors produce anywhere from 20 to 30 tons of high-level radioactive waste every year of operation. That varies between the boiling water reactors like at Clinton and Quad Cities and the pressurized water reactors, which are like Braidwood and Byron. So you can use that as a rough figure, 20 to 30 tons per year. So we figured the three reactors that we saw that were bailed out, the two Mark 1 GE reactors at Quad Cities, which are of the same design as at Fukushima, only older, and the newer Clinton reactor, which is a single reactor in central Illinois. We took those three reactors, multiplied the average out of 30 tons a year times 10 years, and it gets you close to 1,000 tons. So it's over the period of 10 years. I would add, though, that Illinois has, since its very beginning of the nuclear age, late 60s, early 70s, we have an inventory of about 10 to 11,000 tons right now. Over that entire period of time, over the 14 reactors that have operated here in Illinois during that time span, more high-level radioactive waste than any other state. So adding an additional 1,000 tons to that is what we're talking about here. Had those reactors closed, we would have avoided the generation and all the hazards that come with it. I don't have an actual cost figure on that, but for that, we'll probably have to do another press conference on high-level radioactive waste in Yucca Mountain.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Damon, is there anything you would add to that?
Oh, I would just add, in some ways it's an aside, but I think it's an important aside, that the other thing to be thinking about when we talk about irradiated nuclear fuel, the high-level waste that's generated in nuclear reactors, is that you've got to also remember that roughly 1% of the radioactive material in that nuclear waste is plutonium. And that plutonium poses a massive risk of nuclear proliferation. The U.S. actually has tested a nuclear weapon using so-called commercial-grade plutonium, so it's been proven to be possible. So we also need to be thinking, because we actually have to think about nuclear waste as a very long-term problem. And not only is it a problem in terms of isolating it from the environment and from the public, but we also have to realize that over time, nuclear waste becomes potentially a mine for anybody who wants to try to access nuclear weapons material and or use the waste itself as a weapon. And I think that this is an additional part of the cost of the material that has to be thought about. And of course, as any one of us would say, that true cost of storage is not ever discussed and is never taken into account when we think about the true cost of nuclear power.
Well, Dina, what you raise is also a really important consideration. You know, when the industry is decrying what they characterize as unfairness in the in the incentives offered to renewables as opposed to nuclear. This has really been one of many indirect subsidies to the nuclear industry. That the federal government has obligated itself to taking responsibility for the long-term management of the commercial nuclear waste that's produced in these reactors. And in fact, while for several years the industry was required to pay a nominal fee each year into a federal high-level waste fund for the management of this waste, in fact, for more than 4 years now, due to a court judgment, the industry has not had to pay into that fund at all. And so, in effect, by subsidizing these reactors, states are actually providing an incentive for the generation of more of this waste, which is not, which has no way to pay for it at the moment. This is, potentially a risk to states, for the long-term management of this waste going forward, given the failure of the federal government to find a suitable long-term management strategy for this waste. But also, it's potentially imposing liabilities onto U.S. taxpayers, for the management of the waste that's being generated under these subsidies. So, if you have another question, please feel free to dial *6, and we'll put you in the queue. If not, then we will wrap up here shortly. And as I mentioned before. The report is available on NIRS's website at www.nirs.org. If you scroll down to breaking news, there's a link to the press release, which has a link to download the report, the white paper, and we'll also have a recording of this media briefing posted there shortly. So not seeing any more questions, we'll go ahead and wrap up. Thank you to all the journalists who called in today, and we'll be available for questions if you have anything later. Again, the contact numbers for all of the presenters, as well as other organizations that the NIRS consulted with in the creation of the white paper, are on the press release that's posted on our website. I'm seeing a wireless caller who's raised their hand to ask a question, and I'll unmute you now.
This is Jan Bodart from Nuclear Energy Information Service, and I wanted to point out the enormous amount of money that is being poured into new nuclear research. In particular, there's a laboratory called the National, it's called the Gateway for Accelerated Innovation in Nuclear, or GAIN. And a woman recently was placed in charge of that. Her name is Ms. Barnawal. And I'm wondering if there could be somebody make a comment about what I would call unprecedented acceleration and unprecedented funding for nuclear innovation and what it means. Also, I had a question about sodium-cooled reactors. I believe they use much more water than water-cooled reactors, but I'm not sure of that. And I'd like someone to comment on the recent research that goes into sodium-cooled reactors and small modular reactors, which are sort of joined. Thank you.
Dave or David, would either of you like to address any of those questions?
Well, we didn't touch on the issue of new reactors, particularly the SMRs. They're called small modular reactors. But here, too, the nuclear industry is trying to, with smoke and mirrors, promote some sort of a fantastic future, which is many decades down the line, which will have absolutely no positive effect on reversing or dealing with the climate situation today. Even though James Hansen, the great atmospheric scientist, for many years is now touting a next generation of reactors, I had the opportunity of confronting him at a meeting in Chicago a number of years ago and said to him, your point is inconsistent. It's the upfront carbon now that you have told us for years that we must deal with, yet you're hitching your wagon to SMRs and reactors that aren't going to be commercially available for 20 to 30 years. How do you reconcile those two, you know, positions? And his answer was, well, we can have a Manhattan Project and, you know, really knuckle down and build reactors faster. And my reply to that is, well, couldn't we do the same then with renewables? And then he just kind of walked away. So it's a pipe dream. There is money being put into new development of reactors, and it's probably going to be money wasted given the fact that we have 12 years left, if you believe the IPCC. That's about all I'll say on that one.
Well, and I think there's actually a really pertinent report that was issued this summer by a panel of the National Academy of Sciences, which is the nation's top scientific body. And this was a panel that had been evaluating the feasibility of nuclear power as a climate solution for several years, on the theory which they acknowledged that they believed that nuclear would be necessary in order to meet emissions targets. And what this panel found was that, you know, after years of investigation, is that in fact, really, nuclear power is not going to be a viable way of reducing greenhouse gas emissions within the critical 2050, you know, mid-century timeframe. And they addressed each of these issues specifically. One was the aging reactor fleet that's becoming increasingly expensive and unreliable to operate. The failure of what was announced as the Nuclear Renaissance Program a decade ago to build a fleet of new reactors that has by all objective measures been a failure in bankrupting Westinghouse and only resulting in two reactors that are still under construction. They also looked at small modular reactors and acknowledged that in fact, while the cost of SMRs would be less than building a new large reactor, that actually on a unit basis, you know, considering the scale of the reactors, they would actually be more expensive, and there was no real way to justify deploying them at any commercial scale. And then, of course, you know, in turning to advanced reactors and, you know, sodium cooled designs and the kind of things that Jan you asked about, they found that those really were not going to be available commercially for at least decades. And you know, as Dave mentioned, you know, the critical time frame in which we need to reduce emissions is now. I think what that sort of draws you to is that, you know, while we need to have a robust set of tools in order to reduce emissions, and phase out fossil fuels, you know, globally as well as nationally, the nuclear power isn't going to be one of those tools. And that's why we really think that states have to take a pragmatic and practical approach to this, you know, in order to both, you know, mitigate the environmental impacts of nuclear power, but also to be able, to meet the steep path of emissions reductions that are necessary under the recent reports. Damon, anything to add? Okay, well, we are.
No, I think you guys did a great job covering issues.
All right, well, thank you to Dave and Damon, and thanks to all the journalists who called in today. It's now 12 o'clock, and so we'll go ahead and close out the press conference. And like I said, the recording will be available on NIRS's website at www.nirs.org. Thanks very much, everybody.